service.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
This episode contains content that may be disturbing to some listeners. Please check the show notes for more information.
Badlands is a production of Double Elvis.
The stories about Adrienne Shelley are insane. She found success in the world of independent film before being found dead in her apartment. They said it was a suicide, and her husband wasn't convinced. And soon, neither were the cops. A footprint found at the scene of the crime turned the case on its head and led to new revelations about what happened to Adrienne Shelley, who, up until her death at age 40, made great films. Unlike that clip I played for you at the top of the show, that wasn't from a great film. That was a fair use sample from the Library of Congress of Vera Hall performing Awful Death in 1939. I played you that clip because I can't afford the rights to a clip from Darren Lynn Bousman's Saw 3. And why would I play you that specific slice of torture porn cheese? Could I afford it? Because that was the number one movie in America on November 1st, 2006, and that was the day Adrienne Shelley's husband made a gruesome discovery inside her apartment. On this episode, Indie Darlings, A Suspicious Death, Footprints, Revelations in Adrienne Shelley. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Badlands. Andy Ostroy was starting to get nervous. Earlier that day, around 9:30 in the morning, he dropped off his wife, Adrienne Shelley, at her office in Greenwich Village. That office was actually her old apartment, one she kept after they got married to use as a command center for her film projects. She was excited that morning, hoping that today would be the day she'd find out if her latest film, Waitress, had been accepted into the Sundance Film Festival. But that was hours ago, and Andy hadn't heard a peep from Adrienne. She could get sucked in when she was writing, sure. Still, she said she'd be waiting by the phone for word from Sundance. When Andy called in the middle of the day, the phone just rang and rang. And now, Andy's workday at the marketing agency was winding down. It was quitting time. He decided to drive by Adrienne's office, just to check on her, he told himself. A whole day with no word? That wasn't like Adrienne. That uneasy feeling didn't go away the whole ride through Manhattan. In fact, it doubled, tripled even, when Andy pressed Adrienne's intercom doorbell and there was no answer. He exited the elevator on the fourth floor and made the long walk down the carpeted hallway toward Adrienne's office. The building was quiet. Most of the people who lived there were sitting down to dinner or out for the night. There was nothing to swallow up the sound of his own nervous heartbeat echoing in his ears. Finally, he reached a door marked 47. He knocked. Still, no answer. He continued to rationalize inside his own head. Adrian was busy, absorbed by a new script, and that's why she hadn't called or wasn't answering. But it wasn't until Andy tried the doorknob and the unlocked door of Adrian's apartment swung wide open that the first jolt of true fear touched his heart. Adrian Shelley had always been someone who knew what she wanted. If you judged her by her looks, which she felt like a lot of people did, you might not see it at first. She was blonde, with a button nose and large doe-like eyes. Her height, 5'2", made her seem cute and unassuming. But looks can often be deceiving. For Adrian, if you looked past the initial picture, you'd find a woman with layers. A sharp, dark sense of humor. A cynical, dreamlike way of seeing the world. Someone who had perpetual bad luck in the dating department, yet still hoped for love. And finally, deep at her core, a bright flame of ambition. Since she was a kid, Adrian performed. Piano recitals, school plays, Boston University to study film. She was going to be an actress. She knew it. Still, Adrian wasn't one to sit around and let things happen. She knew where she wanted to go, and she wasn't afraid to push things along if she could. So she dropped out of college, moved to New York, and started sending out headshots. One of those headshots landed at the office of Hal Hartley, a new indie director with a shoestring budget looking for the star of his first feature. Specifically, an unknown actress to play a teenager from Long Island. Someone who could be idiosyncratically funny, tough, vulnerable, real. When he saw Adrian's headshot, Hal knew he'd found his lead. The unbelievable truth came out in 1989. And just like that, Adrian Shelley had what she wanted. The Unbelievable Truth was the first in a new wave of indie features taking over the festival circuit. It was the toast of the Toronto International Film Festival. Everyone wanted a piece of the little blonde unknown who made it shine. Miramax bought it, with the promise to distribute it. But first, Miramax boss and first-class creep Harvey Weinstein had some notes. The biggest one, he wanted more nudity from Adrian Shelley. Hal Hartley refused. It was the first inkling of an issue that would plague Adrian for the rest of her career. For now, Adrian had gotten what she wanted. She showed up in music videos and on the front cover of fashion magazines. She was invited to the hottest parties in the village. And of course, the acting offers were pouring in. Some of them, like Hal Hartley's next movie, made Adrian feel like she was finally being seen. Hal liked to write about complex, interesting women dealing with love and heartbreak. But as she quickly discovered, Hal's scripts were the rare ones. Throughout the early 1990s, Adrian starred in a slew of indie movies, trying to emulate what she had with Hal. But these pictures weren't the unbelievable truth, and the writers weren't Hal. She found herself playing the same sort of characters over and over, blonde sexpots with childish emotions, mostly a background decoration to the male lead's character arc. Phone calls from her agent became predictable.
Here's the thing, Adrian. It's really important to these people that you be fuckable.
By 1993, Adrian felt she had to do something. The same drive that made her drop out of college and send those headshots was telling her it was time to try something new. Sitting slumped in her chair, looking around her apartment, she gazed at the posters on the walls of college projects that she loved, the stack of playbills on her desk, all of them productions she'd starred in, all moments when she felt excited about where she was going. At the edge of her desk sat her old typewriter, the cover still snapped on from when she brought it from college. She drew it close to her, shoving the receipts and greeting cards that littered her desk out of the way. She removed the cover, put a fresh sheet of paper on the roller, and started to type. If no one was going to give her the role she wanted, then maybe she would have to create it herself. Upstate New York. 12-year-old Adrienne Levine was finally starting to like it up here. When her parents, back on Long Island, first mentioned sending her away to summer camp, the suggestion hit her like a punch to the gut. "You'll have fun, Adrienne," they told her. All she heard was, "We're getting rid of you." Her mom, she could understand, but it was her dad's betrayal that hurt the most. Sheldon Levine, aka Shelley, was Adrienne's best friend. He was a big man with an even bigger personality, always on Adrienne's side, front row at every dance performance and school play. The person Adrienne asked for advice. She trusted his opinions. She trusted him. But sleepaway camp? She didn't know what Shelley was thinking. Her first few letters hammered that point home. The bathrooms were smelly and the food was nasty and the kids were stuck up and the drama teacher was so lame. She didn't even think she wanted to be in this dumb show. But she had to admit, after a few weeks in the woods, she was maybe just a teeny bit starting to like it here. That's what was on Adrienne's mind when she was told there was a call for her at the office. Maybe she should let her parents off the hook just a little bit. She picked up the phone. She could tell her mother had been crying.
"Adrienne, come home now."
Shelley, her larger-than-life dad, was dead from a heart attack. The sudden loss of Adrienne's father colored her life. She took her father's nickname, Shelley, as a stage name. She found herself drawn to projects about grief and loss. But when she decided to try her hand at creating her own works, she began exploring those same feelings with her quirky sense of humor. She resisted the same old roles Hollywood was offering. She went back to work with a brand new theater company called Missing Children. Here, Adrienne found the collaborator she was craving. It wasn't long before actors like Amy Sedaris and Paul Rudd were up on stage breathing life into her scripts. A few people started coming to the workshops, and then a few dozen. It was no blockbuster, but Adrienne felt encouraged. Maybe she could do this, write and direct something she'd actually want to star in. The next few years, Adrienne chased that dream, some short films, and then she began raising money for features. Most of her projects weren't exactly market-friendly. Surreal, irreverent comedies about quirky women, they don't always put butts in seats, at least not in the 90s. Still, Adrienne was starting to rediscover her love of the industry. She drew on her past bad relationships and the long-standing grief she had from her father's death for her scripts. And they didn't always work, but they did get her some indie attention. Meanwhile, Adrienne was getting attention of her own. As someone who'd often turned her bad luck with love into art, she was used to bad dates and worse boyfriends. Deep down, though, Adrienne wanted it all. A career she controlled, work she could be proud of, and someone to call her own. When she met marketing executive Andy Ostroy in 2001, it started to look like she might finally get what she wanted. Adrienne told her friends she met this guy at a political fundraiser or volunteering downtown after 9/11. Andy told his friends they'd been set up on a blind date. The truth was, in these early days of internet dating, the two didn't want to admit they'd met online. When they decided to meet in person, they agreed they'd only schedule the date for 5 minutes. That way, if it wasn't working out, they could leave. And they ended up talking for 5 hours. Andy was someone who believed in Adrienne's dreams the way she did. He wasn't intimidated by her ambition. He encouraged it. And it didn't hurt that his 3 children from a previous marriage adored Adrienne. Just over a year later, the two married. Adrienne felt like she was on the cusp of something great. She'd just turned 40. Her life was finally starting to take off. She'd found Andy and finally got to do something she'd always wanted, become a mother. Her daughter, Sophie, was her greatest work yet. But the baby wasn't the only thing that had been gestating for 9 long months. Adrienne found herself panicking during her pregnancy about how her life was going to change with a child in it. She turned these fears into a new script titled Waitress, a dark comedy with technicolor tones. It had the audience rooting for 2 characters having an affair. It featured its main characters in her monologue as a series of increasingly unhinged pie recipes. It was still Adrienne's personal brand of weird, but more commercial than anything she'd made yet. As the project started to come together in 2006, Adrienne couldn't help feeling like this was bigger than anything she'd done before. The actors readied themselves to shoot the final scene. You could hear a pin drop. It was so quiet. Adrian was behind the camera, decked out in a waitress uniform and apron. She whispered, "Action," and jumped in front of the camera as the scene began. By the time she yelled, "Cut," she was crying. She'd been in this spot plenty of times before, directing shorts and even a few features. This time, something felt different. She knew this was her ticket to the top. November 1st, 2006. Andy Ostroy's heart dropped as the door to Adrian's apartment creaked open easily. She wasn't answering her phone, or even his knocks at the door. And now, this. The apartment was unlocked and wide open. Andy stepped inside, and the room looked just like it always did. Bare furniture covered in Adrian's creative clutter. CNN blared from a small TV. Balled up typewritten pages and unopened mail covered the desk. The shoes and bags she'd worn that morning were dumped on the floor. She wasn't in the bedroom or the kitchen. Andy turned toward the bathroom door, and as his hand touched the cool brass of the doorknob and then turned the handle, every nerve ending screamed out that something was dreadfully, irrevocably wrong. He could save himself if he just turned back now. But Andy couldn't turn back. He needed to find Adrian. And when the bathroom door swung open, he did. This was all wrong. Andy Ostroy was supposed to be helping Adrian promote Waitress. He was supposed to be schmoozing at parties, calling donors. He was supposed to be with Adrian. But on November 1st, 2006, he found Adrian hanging from the shower curtain with a bedsheet tied around her neck. NYPD were already assuming it was suicide. Andy wasn't buying it. Adrian didn't fit the mold. She was finally feeling successful in her career. She just wrapped a big feature. She was utterly devoted to her 2-year-old daughter. The morning she died, she even called up friends to make plans for the weekend. Suicide felt extremely unlikely. The cops didn't want to hear it. Andy called the 6th precinct that Friday, 2 days after Adrian's death. He was told that there was only one detective assigned to her case, and they were off for the weekend. Besides, the cops told him, it was a suicide. They knew it was hard to swallow, but Andy would just have to accept that Adrian had taken her own life. But Andy Ostroy wasn't about to let go.
We'll be right back after this
word.
There was something suspicious about Adrian Shelley's death. Her husband, Andy Ostroy, knew this in his gut. And after talks with some of the more open ears down at the Greenwich Village police station, some cops were starting to agree with him. On the outside, it certainly looked like a suicide. It had all the classic hallmarks. But there were all these little details that weren't adding up, like the knot. Adrian was found hanging from a bedsheet tied to the shower curtain rod. There was something odd about the bedsheet. It wasn't tied in a simple knot or a hangman's noose. Instead, the sheet was tied with a complicated, unique knot that the cops didn't even recognize. If Adrian had decided to go through with suicide, it was likely a split-second decision. Not exactly a time to learn a complicated new knot. When detectives showed a picture of the knot to Andy, his immediate response was she didn't know how to tie a bedsheet like that. Hell, he couldn't even tie a knot like that. And then there were the marks on the body. The medical examiner's autopsy revealed bruises on her face and hands, bruises that looked like the aftermath of a struggle. If Adrian had hanged herself, who exactly was she fighting with? All this, paired with Andy's nonstop calls to the station to investigate further, convinced the NYPD it was time to take another look. The day of the autopsy, homicide detectives went back to Adrian Shelley's apartment. They broke the police department seal on apartment 47. The room was just as Adrian had left it, minus a few things the cops had taken into evidence. The detectives worked slowly and methodically, going back over Adrian's desk, her papers, looking for any sign of something out of place. The medical examiner seemed to think there had been a struggle. But to the detectives, the apartment looked normal, if a little messy. No blood on the ground, nothing broken or thrown in a fight. Just the last remnants of Adrian Shelley's life. After they'd examined nearly every square inch of the apartment, the two detectives finally headed toward the bathroom. In the tub, they found nothing. No one noticed marks on the shower curtain rod where the bedsheet was tied. No blood or hair in the sink. It was a dead end. They began to pack it all up and call it a day. Then, one of them spotted something. It was faint, but it was there. A mark of some kind, on top of the closed toilet lid. Maybe gray dust. The detective couldn't quite make it out. He reached into his bag and retrieved some magnet powder and a small brush. Gently, carefully, he brushed the soft powder over the mark. The metal particles clung to the outline of the dust, bringing a new image to light. A man's shoe print. From there, things moved fast. The investigation was officially moved to the homicide department, and the detectives started brushing up on shoes. The sneaker they were looking for was a Reebok Allen Iverson size 8. Unfortunately for them, a pretty popular shoe. Yet for how many pairs it sold, it was pretty hard to find any for sale near the crime scene. None of Adrian's or Andy's shoes matched the print, which ruled them out. The cops and EMTs who visited the scene were all wearing work boots, not sneakers. Police canvassed the building, but none of the other tenants' shoes matched either. By the time the detectives were asking neighbors down the street for their shoe size, they knew they needed something else to go on. One detective was curious about the gray dust that formed the shoe print. He noticed seeing similar dust in Adrian's apartment and around the building, and he asked the super about it. It's probably just construction dust, the super told him. It's getting everywhere from the work they're doing in apartment 37. Apartment 37, directly underneath Adrian's apartment. With the super's help, the detectives made their way inside apartment 37, and they found their answer staring them in the face. In the middle of the floor, clear in the gray construction dust, were footprints from a Reebok Allen Iverson sneaker, size 8. None of the construction workers were in on that weekend, but once again, the super came in handy. He directed the detectives to the apartment of the foreman, an Ecuadorian immigrant named Wilson Filco. The street was quiet when detectives arrived at Wilson Pilko's Brooklyn apartment. He entered the door quickly, surprised to see the police at his doorstep but not outwardly nervous. The detectives asked him if he knew Adrian Shelley, the lady that died upstairs in the apartment building? No, he never met her. Just saw her walking by once or twice. Terrible thing to happen, just awful. The police kept asking questions, kept pushing him. But it was obvious that Wilson Pilko didn't know any more than they did. They thanked him for his time, and they began to take their leave. And then, they saw it. A backpack over by the staircase, with a pair of Reeboks poking out. The detective stopped in their tracks. Are those your sneakers? Wilson shook his head. They belonged to his 19-year-old brother, Diego. What about Diego? The detectives asked. Did he do any work at the apartment building? Of course, Wilson told him. In fact, Diego was working there the same day that poor lady died. Andy had been sitting by the phone all day. It was Monday, November 6th, 5 days since Adrian's death. If she were here, she would have been doing the same thing. It was judgment day for Waitress, the day they found out whether the film had been accepted by the Sundance Film Festival. Andy jumped when he heard the phone finally ring. But there was no cheerful Sundance rep on the other end. Instead, he recognized the gruff voice of a 6th Precinct detective. The man asked Andy how quickly he could be ready to go. Go where? Asked Andy. The police station. They needed Andy downstairs in 10 minutes. They got the guy who killed Adrian. It was easy enough to find Wilson Pilko's 19-year-old brother, Diego. He was at the house when detectives first came to interview Wilson. Diego readily admitted the size 8 Reeboks were his, which the homicide lab confirmed were the same shoes that left the print in Adrian's apartment. When the questions turned to Adrian's death, though, Diego clammed up. He was in the interrogation room for hours, the whole time denying he had ever seen Adrian Shelley in the building. They were getting nowhere. so one detective thought it might be time to try a different tactic. The detective began to ask Diego questions about his family. It took some coaxing, but before long, he got to talking. He'd come from Ecuador to New York City for work. He had his brother out here and some cousins, but he missed his family back home. The detective saw her opening. She asked him about his family. Did he have any kids? Diego shook his head. He was only 19. No kids yet, but he did like them. Maybe he'd have some of his own one day. What about little cousins running around? Nephews? Nieces? Diego lit up. He started talking about the kids and his family. One of his nieces was just 4 years old, and he was sad he wasn't there to see her grow up. The detective saw her chance. She asked what he knew about the woman who had died in the apartment building. Did he know she had a 2-year-old daughter? He didn't know that. Did he know that now the little girl had no mother at all? He didn't know that either, he said. He was sorry. That was the final crack in Diego Pilco's armor. He broke down and confessed that he killed Adrian Shelley. Diego Pilco never set out to kill anyone. At least that's what he told the detectives. He was working in apartment 37 when he said Adrian came down, complaining about the construction noise. It wasn't the first time that she complained, and she was upset. The conversation escalated, he told the police, until Diego, in a fit of rage, threw a hammer at her, missing her head by inches. She screamed that she was calling the cops and stormed out of the room. Diego knew he'd made a big mistake. He was undocumented, and any run-in with the police might mean he'd get deported. So he followed her to her apartment, just to stop her, he said. But somehow, things got out of hand. When he got there, Adrian was heading for the phone. When she saw him following her into the apartment, she turned and slapped him in the face. Diego lunged at her. He hit her back, knocking her to the ground and sending the phone flying. He ran after the phone to make sure she didn't have a chance to call. When he turned back, he saw that Adrian wasn't moving. She was lying motionless on the floor, a huge bruise already forming on her forehead. In his rush to stop her from calling the cops, he must have killed her. Diego only had one thing on his mind, getting caught. So he did the only thing he could think of. He remembered seeing something in an old telenovela, someone covering up murder with a staged suicide. So he tied a bedsheet to the curtain rod, using a knot he learned working on a hog farm in Ecuador. And he left Adrian there for her husband, Andy, to find. Even with a suspect under arrest, things still didn't totally add up to Andy and Adrian's family. Adrian wasn't a confrontational person. Diego's story about her screaming over a noise complaint didn't make sense. When the police tested her shoes for construction dust, they found nothing, meaning she'd never been in apartment 37 that day, which meant that Diego's story wasn't the whole truth. Facing a life sentence, Diego Pilco decided to take a plea deal for manslaughter in the first degree, only getting 25 years. One condition of the deal was that he finally had to come clean about what happened on November 1st, 2006. This time, Diego Pilco claimed there was no confrontation over noise. That wasn't a catalyst. Money was. Diego owed a lot of money to the people who brought him over from Ecuador, more than he could pay back. His mother, who put her house up for collateral, risked losing her home, and the moneylenders were starting to get angry. So Diego started stealing, and it wasn't enough. He was in and out of houses and apartments all the time working construction jobs. He stole cash out of wallets or small things he could hawk at the pawn shop. Adrian was just supposed to be another quick cash grab. He'd seen her in the apartment building and thought she looked like she had money. So when he walked past her open apartment door and saw her purse sitting there, he decided to act, sneak in, snag some cash, then leave without her suspecting a thing. But as he rummaged through her purse, a shout came from behind him. There was Adrian, phone in hand, threatening to call the cops. He rushed at her, hitting her in the face, desperate to stop her. He couldn't afford to get picked up by the police. She was screaming, so he put a hand over her mouth and squeezed her neck to keep her quiet. He didn't need a curious neighbor coming to see what all the noise was about. Eventually, she stopped making noises. When he let her go, she slumped to the floor. Just like he related in his first story, he panicked and staged the suicide. According to him, that part was true. The police and Adrian's family weren't sure what to believe. Here was a guy who killed a woman and tried to blame her for starting it, who invented a fight to make himself look better. Whatever the truth, they found it was his final act, the cover-up, that sealed Adrian's fate. When the coroner's report finally came back, it stated that Adrian had died from compression of the neck. It wasn't Diego's attack that killed her. It was the bedsheet around her neck. Diego Pilco had moved to the U.S. at 19 for a new life, but before he even really started living it, his decisions cut it short. He committed a horrific act, murdering a stranger for money. Instead of chasing the American dream, he spent the next 25 years inside the American prison system. As for Adrian, it's clear she was cut down on her way up. The same day the NYPD arrested Diego Pilco, her movie Waitress was accepted into Sundance. In the years since, her husband and friends have tried to make sure Adrian's memory doesn't disappear. Andy set up a foundation that funds young women filmmakers. After Waitress's blockbuster opening at Sundance, a theater producer bought the rights. Beginning in 2016, 10 years after Adrian died, people could see her Technicolor dream on stage, complete with songs by Sarah Bareilles. For someone so small, Adrian Shelley sure left a huge impact. One that ought to be in pictures. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Badlands.